Hello, and welcome to another episode of I Am The Egg Pod, hosted by me, Chris Shaw. You can find me on Twitter as @ChrisShawEditor. The Egg Pods take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland, discussing the Beatles and solo Beatle albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. In this episode, I'm joined by journalist, writer and broadcaster, Samira Ahmed.
Hello.
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 Samira can be found on Twitter as @SamiraAhmedUK. So Samira, where did you first hear this album? When did you get into it? Where did Hard Day's Night come into this?
I have sort of two sources for it. One is the BBC showed all the Beatles films at Christmas 1978, I think it was. And I remember watching them and just falling in love with them. I had an elder brother who was born in 1963, so he was already playing a lot of Beatles music, and I grew up very much with his tastes. And weirdly, this is one of the first albums I bought. So we went to HMV and I bought the record. Thought, oh, I know this album from the film and I will love it. And my brother managed to con me into doing a swap. I gave him this album and he gave me the bootleg Beatles at the Star Club Hamburg, plus a David Soul single. I went, oh yeah, but you get two Beatles records for one. And he just, you know, I was so young. So, I brought mine in. This is the second copy I've had to go out and buy because my elder brother managed to con me. Because we had a VCR in 1978, we taped all these films. So I watched A Hard Day's Night hundreds and hundreds of times. I used to come in from school and watch it at least once or twice a week. And I was fascinated by the locations. And then I had another encounter with it. Although I'd loved all the Beatles, I used to have a little Beatles badge I used to wear to school when I started secondary school. In 1979, I'm going to school wearing a Beatles badge. I was really obsessed with them. When I was a bit older and I was living in Battersea, there was an R Price Records on St John Street in Clapham Junction. And I just remember going in one day and they were playing A Hard Day's Night and they were playing side two. Mm. And of course, none of the tracks were on the film. And I remember thinking, God, this is a good album. And And that's when I went back and kind of dug it out again. Yeah. And I just think it's, I know you'll have lots of people disagreeing. I think in a way it's their best album because it captures the peak of Beatlesness.
Yes.
And every single song on it is flawless.
And it's almost a solo John Lennon album from 64. I think there's only three tracks.
Oh, don't say that.
From Paul.
My favourite Beatle is George, and I like his songs on this.
He's on this. He is. And also, again, a lot of people won't agree with this, I think George was the best actor in Hard Day's Night. Better than
George?
Ringo. Yes.
Well, that's controversial.
I know.
I do think Ringo's the best actor. And the other thing, which you can maybe talk about later, is I have been round many of the locations of this film because I grew up in southwest London. I still live there. And this book, The Beatles London, which I've put my copy in, and we could maybe put up a photograph of it, which is, you know, this walking guide to all the locations from their career. And it had all the specific places that they filmed around Twickenham Studios for A Hard Day's Night and Help. And when the book came out in 1994, I bought a copy. And I was going through it last night. I actually ticked off with places I'd gone and I marked the dates in them.
Genius.
Because it was the year it came out. It was end of October, 1st of November 1994. And I went round. Yeah. I did a whole day and I planned my itinerary and, you know, things like, the studios themselves, the pub where Ringo gets kicked out.
Oh, yeah.
The Riverside Walk at Kew Bridge where he meets the boy and, you know, kind of goes.
Where he was really hungover, apparently, wasn't he, when he was filming that?
Where he goes parading, yes, apparently he was hungover. But what's really interesting about some of those semi-suburban locations is they hadn't really changed that much. The Riverside at Kew is still a lovely place to meander. And, although it's the film that got me into the album, I think I just love that atmosphere of the mid-60s. And, you know, even central London locations. I mean, the theatre where they filmed that sequence of the running around the back of Scala Street. You know, Scala Street is still there. And if you walk into the Mews, you can still imagine the queues of kids outside. Yeah. And I love that sense of, you know, a London of ghosts where things have faded, but they're still sort of, the imprints are still there, the traces are still there.
And you've got this photo, which was published online as well, isn't it, that you got from Oxfam, I believe.
Yeah, so we used to live in Marylebone, right near Marylebone Station, where they filmed a lot of it. And, of course, there's a big Beatles tour that goes around those locations. And just as we were moving, we moved out to the suburbs about 14 years ago, and we spotted this in the local Oxfam bookshop, and it was in a lovely wooden frame as well. And it's John and Ringo running into Marylebone Station with the crowds chasing them, and it's from obviously during the shooting of the opening sequence to the film. And what I love is, because there's only two of them in it, and you can see John Lennon's kind of really skinny legs.
Yeah.
And they almost look like stick men. They're kind of mid-air.
They're like the cartoons, aren't they?
They are like the cartoons. And I think it was taken by a stills photographer who was presumably taking photos on set. In fact, there's a photo in the current issue of Mojo with Paul McCartney on the cover, which looks to me like it's taken by the same photographer from a slightly different angle. Yeah. So it's like my little piece of 60s Marylebone, which was a place that I never lived there in the 60s, but I lived there a little bit later. And I used to live in Montague Square on the corner with the house which Ringo owned, where John and Yoko got busted.
Yes, yeah. So that's another podcast.
I know. I know all the locations, and I've been to a lot of them.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. I mean, the album itself, as you say, it totally sums up Beatlemania. The first time, pure Lennon-McCartney songs. I think they've met Dylan by this point, and I think
had they, though? Because it's 64, isn't it? I mean, what I find weird is that they were writing the songs on tour. Because there's a bit on the sleeve notes which talks about them. They get a grand piano brought into their hotel room in the Georges V. But the idea that they wrote six more brilliant songs, which they didn't have time for in the film, and they write them while they're busy gigging.
Well, the itinerary, it was insane. They first started recording the first song in Paris. And that was a daytime session before one of their concerts at the Olympia Theatre. Then I Want to Hold Your Hand got to number one in America, so they went off to conquer America, and then they came back and finished the album off in June, before then heading off for a world tour. So I think in 64, when they went to America, that's when they met Dylan, because he was saying...
So there is Dylan comes in the middle there somewhere.
I think possibly the influence more was the fact that they assumed that he'd written all of his own songs on the album, even though a lot of them were the trad R Dylan. And I think that sort of side of it inspired them.
What I find interesting is this claim about the title track, that song inspired the whole career of the Byrds. Yes. Is that true?
I'd
in fact,
say
not
more,
just that track, but that single guitar chord.
I'd say probably what influenced was George bought the 12-string Rickenbacker at the time, which is on so many of these tracks. And I think that was what inspired them, because then they went out and bought their 12-strings Rickenbacker. But they used that as the focal point.
I made one really good Vine. You remember Vine before they shut it down? Those little 7-second films. And I had this genius idea, and it was my first one. And it was a 7-second Vine, which is the album cover, taking it out the sleeve, putting it on the turntable, and then hearing that opening chord. And that's my 7-second Vine.
Yes, good awesome, one. Yeah. And that crash is, as you know, as album starters go, that's quite a distinctive noise.
Yeah, and I just, you know, I know my associations are tied up with the film, but that sense of, you know, the machinery of a train, of this relentless pressure and momentum. I think that's what I quite like about that song. You get a sense of, it's a beautiful song, and yet it's at you're inside the train of Beatle madness.
And it's just pure joy. It's the camaraderie as well. You know, John and Paul are sharing the vocals, and it's like, they're so close, they're so tight at this time. You know they're going through this Beatlemania chaos.
But also this, you know, all the little stories about how the title came about. And a bit like, you know, there's James Bond theme titles, which are sort of puns that we now got used to, like You Only Live Twice. I just think A Hard Day's Night, I don't know what the circumstances were in which Ringo said it, but, you know, it's just lovely, the idea that they were kind of coining these little phrases that we now think of, like 8 days a week. These are all phrases that we use now in conversation. They've kind of become idioms, haven't they, of English?
Okay. 1, 2, 3, 4. That's not it. You're playing this, boy. 1, 2, 3, 4. I missed the beat. 1, 2, 3, 4.
It's been a hard day's night, and I've been working like a dog. It's been a hard day's night.
Yeah, it is the energy of it. I was listening to the whole album again ahead of coming to talk to you, and it is like getting on a train with them, you know, and then everything's rushing by outside the window, and then you get off at the end.
And you've got in the film as well that frenetic beginning. It reminds me of the beginning of Train Spotting, where they're
rather
running Train Spotting along.
Reminds you of the beginning of our
But
I think you're right about the chords as well. I mean, I read music and I play the piano, but I don't know enough about the musicology of the Beatles. I just enjoy good music when I hear it. But there's something about the kind of echoing effect of those great chords all the way through. And I know we'll come to it at the end, but, you know, I'll Be Back, for me, is, you know, it's really interesting if you listen to the kind of those great echoing chords on it and then you take it back to the opening track. There's something about, that's the distinctive sound of this album for me.
Okay, ready? Oh, the running. A 1, 2, 3, 4. After I've done that mouth organ bit, can we skip the mouth organ? And when I whisper, I couldn't hear what chords they were going to. Did you go to the middle? Bit less of George. I feel as though I'm singing in a sock.
So that's I Should Have Known Better.
Having said this is a perfect album, this is probably the track I like least. And I think it's partly from watching the film, where I always felt it was a bit of a filler. And they're sitting around with the schoolgirls playing cards and smoking. It's one I used to forward. So maybe I just have the wrong kind of association with it. But actually, it's this piece of music and structure with the harmonica and everything on it. Mm. It's great. It's good. It's a rollicking, you know.
And I love that song. Bit where Lennon runs out of breath halfway through the harmonica solo at the beginning. So I just put... But and obviously Patti Boyd, when she met George on the train.
It's really weird. I knew from very early on that, you know, that's where they met and that they got married. But she must have been 20 or something at the time. There was something really weird about that whole schoolgirls and knee socks thing. Mm. And it's partly that because it was also, it was high fashion. So Marianne Faithfull, there's very famous photographs of her. And if you see Julie Christie in Darling, which is 65, she goes around in knee socks and a kind of corduroy skirt. And it's, and she does make it look very cool, but you just can't do that anymore.
No,
it just doesn't look right, does it?
No.
It's still weird when you think how crazy fandom was around them, that there was still a kind of innocence about the way that you could just get in crowds of genuine fans to chase them down a platform and you wouldn't worry about anything bad happening to them.
Take four.
Would you promise to be true?
John.
And help me.
John.
Understand.
I'm tired.
Yeah.
Sure, okay.
I'm cracking anyway.
The last one.
Hmm.
Okay.
Rolling.
If I fell in love with you, would you promise to be true and help me understand? 'Cause I've been in love before and I found that love was more than just holding hands.
If I fell.
I do love this song, and I think it's partly the harmonies. I really love the harmonies on this album. And it's partly that sort of gentle... plodding sound. I think it's also, it's one of the ones I could play really well on the piano because so there are a lot of traumatic memories coming out here. But when I was young, my mother, and I still sort of believed in Father Christmas, even though I didn't, my mother said to me, there's a special Father Christmas at the BBC. There's a special BBC Santa. My mother used to work at Bush House. And, you know, he gets presents for, you know, children of BBC employees. I don't know why she said this because it's not true. Honestly, no wastage of white license to pay his money. She said, what would you like? And I said, what song did I ask for? I asked for something like the Sound of Music songbook or something, you know, quite tame. And she got me the Beatles songbook with those really weird erotic photos.
Oh,
you know,
Alan Aldridge.
Yeah, the naked skelter with spray-painted naked women and stuff.
Yeah.
But it had all the sheet music in it. Mm. So I played all the Beatles songs. And in some cases, I learnt to play Beatles songs on the piano that I didn't yet know and I'd never encountered them on albums. In fact, I think I may have got that before I ever saw the film.
Mm.
So anyway, If I Fell is one of the songs that I learnt to play on the piano, and it's kind of lovely and sweet and slightly ploddy on the piano.
And this song, along with, there's so many songs, if you read the lyrics without hearing the music, it's a very insecure and...
Is it one of those jealousy
songs? It's this one in particular. I mean, John is desperately insecure, and so he's effectively demanding unconditional love. You know, I've been in love before. I couldn't stand the pain. Reading it, it's there's quite a few songs that are very, very insecure, and you think, well, hang on, you're the Beatles, you know, you've got the world at your feet. But there's still this insecurity that's sort of coming through.
It's funny, isn't it? Because, again, my association is the way he sings it in the film, which is, you know, they're trying to cheer up Ringo. Yeah. He's in a grump.
Yeah.
And so you don't hear it at all in the actual meaning of the lyrics. You just see it being performed as a kind of joke.
Yeah.
But there's a whole thing about, I mean, he's dead, so I guess we can say these things about John Lennon. While I have huge admiration for him as an artist, the more I read about his marriage to Cynthia, the more awful I felt. You know, and I think about her as this young, talented art student in her own right, a really talented artist who, and I remember interviewing Jim Dale, who was a pop star in the 50s, and there was something similar about that. You know, you weren't supposed to be married because being a huge teenage star meant you had to keep this all quiet. So she's forced to kind of creep around like she's not really there, even though he is married. And to suddenly find yourself a housewife who doesn't even get to behave with the rights of a housewife, you know, she's hidden away. And then, you know, the domestic abuse. I think we sometimes have chosen to overlook that. But one wonders what kind of career she might have had as a young artist.
Yes,
in the early 60s. You think of Pauline Boty or Pauline Boty, who Ali Smith's novel Autumn is about, a 60s pop artist. You know, there weren't many women artists at the time, but I sometimes think Cynthia might.
There is a book, Cynthia Lennon book. Check it out. I think it's still on Amazon. I think it's still in print, but it's fantastic. All of her paintings throughout the years, and also lots of ones of Paul and John when they were kids. So I think she came out the other side with a lot of grace. After what
I think
she went
that's
through.
Really nicely put. I think she's one of those people who got kind of sucked into the machine, didn't quite know what was going to happen, and kind of had all her prospects ruined. And the one thing you thought you did have was at least, you know, he's going to stick with me. And then, I don't know, coming home and finding them in your beds.
I know. There's a photo of, I think it was when John filmed How I Won the War, when he's coming back to London Airport. And it's a really weird photo. It's him with Cynthia. And it was taken the day before he went to the Indica, where he met Yoko.
Oh, yeah.
And she looked so happy, and he's just got this sort of glazed look in his eyes, which he did for a couple of years after that. And it's just a really sad photo, because you think, as of tomorrow, you know, it's kind of all the way down for you.
I always have this real thing of sadness about pop stars who split with the girlfriends or partners who were with them from before. It still happens a lot, especially when they've been together for years. It always breaks my heart.
Well, there's a lot of breaking hearts in the Beatles stories, unfortunately. And also, I recommend, have you heard The Ruttles with a Girl Like You?
Well, I'm a huge fan of The Ruttles. And in fact, I went to, there's a Ruttles evening that the BFI held about 20 years ago, Neil Innes. And who's the guy who played Barry?
Barry Wom.
Barry Wom was there.
Was it Halsey?
He's now two hairdressers.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
No, I absolutely adored that film. And in fact, that album I used to play a lot, so my kids' first experience of the Beatles was weirdly hearing the Ruttles rather than
No
the
way.
Yeah, we used to play that album all the time.
Just to confuse them.
Which from a really young age.
Which one's
number
nasty?
Number one.
Yeah.
Before this dance is through, I think I love you too. I'm so happy when you dance with me. I don't wanna kiss or hold your hand. If it's only try and understand, there is really nothing else I'd rather do. 'Cause I'm happy just to dance.
I am happy just to dance with you. George, your favourite, singing this.
Yeah, I'm the first to admit his voice isn't the strongest. I don't know, it's sweet.
Yeah, it's George.
Do you want to hear my George Harrison story?
Go on.
I've got two George Harrison stories,
tell
none
them
of
both.
Which involved me actually meet George Harrison. First, okay, so he was my favourite, and part of it was he was the one who was into Indian culture. And when I was growing up, you know, especially in the 70s, it was a really big deal to know the Beatles loved Indian culture. Ravi Shankar had played in our house. My mother...
What?
Yeah, we used to have music parties, and there was one occasion where he came and performed. And it was the fact that he had an association with the Beatles that excited me. So in a sense, it helped me validate my appreciation of my parents' culture at a time when you're trying to work out, is Indian culture embarrassing or not? And so there was an element of huge pride, but also weirdly, I had a cousin who was much older and was in the Indian Merchant Navy, and he would occasionally come and visit.
Mm.
And he came with, it was one of George Harrison's solo albums called George Harrison. And he came, he gave it to you as a present and said, oh, you know, George Harrison's a friend of mine. And, you know, I can't remember, even said, oh, you know, and he gave me this. And so I thought I'd give it to you because I know you really like the Beatles and you love George Harrison. And of course, I never stopped to ask, well, he hasn't signed it.
Yeah, how dare
he? Where's the photographic evidence that he's a friend of yours? Yeah. And, you know, I was young enough, I was about 10, to think that this was really true, that I had a cousin who knew George Harrison. Oh. And in a way, I think about it now, one, my cousin actually looked a lot like George Harrison in the 70s. He had the sort of same kind of curly hair. Yeah. But also, you know, because the whole thing about the Beatles... Liverpool in the late 50s, early 60s was this town of merchant seamen and sailors bringing American records and American comics. And the idea that my own merchant seaman cousin was coming with his tall stories and his records.
Yeah.
And I still have the album he gave me.
Oh, it's a brilliant
album.
You
know, and it is quite a good album.
Blow away.
And so one of the things on it is, you know, George Harrison had this obsession with Grand Prix, which seems really odd for someone who seems to be sort of into environmental issues and transcendental meditation. Yeah. And I did the quiz Pointless with... Steve Ryder, the sports commentator. Yeah, a few months ago.
How
and
did you do? Or we not allowed to say?
No, it's already come and gone. Some of us did quite well. And Steve had a bit of bad luck where his sports questions were so obvious that he got them all wrong because it couldn't possibly be that simple.
Yeah.
But he's absolutely lovely. And afterwards, he and me and Emma Kennedy sat in the airport lounge waiting for our flight back. And we got talking. And I don't know how it came up, but he had been to Friar Park because George Harrison was hugely into Grand Prix, and I think they must have met at some Grand Prix event. You need to get Steve Ryder on to do one so he can tell you the full story. But basically, George Harrison had written another song about Damon Hill.
And he
played it to Steve Ryder, and Steve said it was god awful.
Oh no! Can you remember any of the lyrics?
No, he did. I think Steve had blanked them. But it was just a weird thing that you get to go to the house of one of the Beatles, and he's going to perform a song for you that he's not played for anyone else, and it's god awful. Because there's a song because the song on the George Harrison album is called
Faster than a bullet from a gun. He is faster than everyone.
That one. So, and that isn't that brilliant a song. So you imagine bad song.
Oh.
That, and obviously it was written years later and it references... Yeah. And Damon Hill's not the most exciting personality.
No. It's sort of like... Yeah. Could have been worth... He could have been to golf or something like the Ballesteros tribute.
The only thing I will say, and again, I know I talk about the film, but I think George has the best corduroy jackets and polo neck jumpers in this film.
He does, yeah.
He looks amazing.
He pulls fashion off very well, doesn't he?
And I know smoking is not good, and I knew it in the 70s, but with his cheekbones and him drawing on a cigarette, he did look beautiful.
Yeah. Don't smoke, kids.
But of course he died of lung cancer, didn't he?
Yeah.
Even though he'd given up years ago.
Yeah. Anyway, Hard Day's Night. Cheery album.
Lessons for young people.
The Beatles, look to them for everything. That's what I say.
And if you saw my love, I love you.
Ready one.
And I love her.
So I've changed my view about this song. I used to find it kind of... I don't know if I changed my mind. I think it's quite cheesy. Again, it was one of those ones I'd be tempted to fast forward through the film because it didn't have a lot of energy in it. But I do like the whole Spanish guitar sound. And it's sweet and unpretentious. And that's kind of... the essence of some of these early Paul McCartney songs, isn't it?
Because there's a version they did before this, which was a full band version, and they just quit that. So they were putting all of their experimentation into the songwriting process rather than into the studio, which they did later. And Paul very gracefully has said that George should have had a songwriting credit for coming up with that riff, because without that riff...
Because that's the thing is, you know, it's got all these elegant elements to it, and it does feel beautifully constructed. I sometimes think... The guitar on this album, it's sort of like, it's a combination of the idea of a harp, but there's all these ripples of sound going through it. But also, you know, if you think about curtains hanging and sort of swaying in the breeze, I sometimes think there's that sense of vertical sounds and you're kind of navigating your way through these different chord arrangements. It's a bit exotic. If you think of it, in the 90s, that whole easy listening revival, and you had the kind of Mike Flowers Pops versions of songs.
Yeah.
The thing about And I Love Her is... it doesn't sound like an easy listening song, but it has exactly those elements that would then be used in that way. Yeah. So it manages, in a way, not to be cheesy.
Yeah, it's just out of the corn belt, isn't it?
Yeah, there's something quite genuine about it.
And I love hearing these earlier songs where they're just testing their own, how far we can go with the song, you know, key change.
I was just going to say, the key changes, the atmosphere to it. I mean, it's a beautiful little... It's almost like if you think about a classical composer making an experimental composition as an exercise, and it's a beautiful little put-together piece.
Ending, and it's a minor key, and it just ends on that major key.
Yeah, there's a phenomenon of that in 60s songs. So there's the guy who wrote No Milk Today, and he also wrote For Your Love.
Graham Gouldman.
Yeah, and yeah. Both those songs, they're in minor keys, and they go major in the chorus, which is the opposite.
Yes.
The way they work. And this does something similar, doesn't it?
Yeah, there's a term for that.
Yeah.
I wrote it down. Thanks. Which I only learnt the other day.
You can drop it in later as if you dropped it in the conversation. And there's also the track ordering, because the way these tracks are dropped in before and after much more energetic ones. Because what comes after And I Love Her is kind of like, it's like Twist and Shout, isn't it?
Yeah.
In terms of intensity and sort of sexual charge.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Tell me why.
Start again.
What did you do then? You made a mistake.
I know you did.
Tell me.
Tell Me Why is just the most enthusiastic song I think they recorded at this point. I absolutely love it. My favourite one.
I always hear it thinking about all the screaming of the audience in the film. Because I think it's the song that comes closest to the climax of the concert. Sorry, it doesn't it end with She Loves You?
Yeah, She Loves You, isn't it, at the end?
Yeah, but Tell Me Why has... Tell Me Why is like cartwheels. It's like, this is a song that's like a circus act, and they're cartwheeling and they're juggling at the same time. You know, it's got that sense of a big circus about it.
And again, one of those ones where lyrically, it's one of the saddest lyrics John ever wrote.
Which is the bit about apologise. Tell me what he's saying, I've forgotten. You're dirty on my own.
Yeah, if there's something I've said or done, tell me what and I'll apologise.
If you don't, I can't go on.
I really can't go on, holding back these tears in my eyes. Which melody that are going with those lyrics?
Was that part of the influence of people like Smokey Robinson? I'm just thinking of, you know, Tears of a Clown.
Yeah, it could be,
these songs
it?
That have these amazing... again, you think about that song. It's got this kind of tumbling sense of circus-like construction, the way the sounds work. And it really sounds really upbeat, but the lyrics are quite dark.
Yeah. Well, they loved Motown, didn't they?
Yeah.
And the falsetto on, if there's anything I can do, that was, well.
It's hard now, because I encountered the Beatles before I encountered too many other 60s bands, but I still feel listening to this, it's like they invented a sound, and it sort of sounds out of time.
Yes.
You know, we now associate, we hear it, we think, oh, this is the mid-60s. But actually, at the time, it sounded like nothing else.
Mm.
And it still sounds like nothing else.
Sorry, I'm veering off into just want to you play it now.
Well, what's been lovely about being asked to do this is, you know, stuff they think, yeah, I know I love this album. But actually being forced to stop and think about why do I love it? And actually appreciating the different elements that go into it.
Yes.
And thinking how young they were. I still can't get over. Like, incredible. You know, like the whole career is how much they did in 10 years or 8 years. Mm. This album is like those 8 years crushed into one album out of all the albums. Yeah. The speed of what they're doing, the speed at which they're developing, it's, you know, you could slow this down and it would take 10 years for other people, wouldn't it? But also putting out 2 albums a year.
I know, and touring and
is
TV appearances.
Beatles for Sale and Rubber Soul, are they 6 months apart?
Not far off, no. Yeah. I think they're all pretty 6 months apart, weren't they, around that time?
God.
Insane.
When you think about the acceleration of modern culture,
all
the more since the internet, I find we should be in awe of what they were doing in the 60s.
And the quality never dropped.
Like, I know this sounds like a really banal comparison, but I was talking to someone about, you know, the new Star Trek film, the J. Abrams one, which has just fallen through. Do you think it's been 10 years since the first one? You know, the Beatles were from start to finish was only 8 in terms of album releases.
Incredible.
Can't buy me love.
Can't buy me love.
I'm jumping along listening to that again
it's
out loud.
Great,
it's
isn't
so
it?
Lovely. And I have been to the field where they filmed it.
There's a famous, well, not so famous, there's an album released in America called Hear the Beatles Tell All. It's one of these interview albums. And they interview them all separately and they ask them their favourite part of the film. And it's the bit in the field, every single one of them. But you've been there.
Yeah, and it hasn't really changed. I think it's at Thornbury Fields. It's in Hounslow.
Right.
And again, it's I did this Beatles Day and I looked up the address, which is in the Beatles London book, and I went there, and it's full of dog walkers. I remember thinking at the time they recorded, I don't expect there was dog shit all over the playing field. But it's weird because it's quite near Heathrow. It's just off one of the kind of, I think it's off the main sort of London road around Hounslow. And, you know, it's still, thank God, an open park.
Mm.
And I think part of what I love about this album, what I associate with it, was this sense of how they were the sound of suburbia as much as they were the sound of, you know, the big city centre. And this energy of, actually, this whole youthquake energy that comes across in their films.
Mm.
And then these little parts of the suburbs of London where they were hanging around for a day filming it.
Yeah.
I'm going to look it up. It's address. Hang on. So you can see, this is my book. You can see how I've ticked off all the places I went. It's done by postcode. Oh, can you see the little blue ink where I'm a bit
Margaret.
Sad. Miss Hospital Corners. I ticked off all the areas around where they filmed it.
Here we go.
Thornbury Playing Fields.
Ah.
Which is, it's in Isleworth in Hounslow.
Okay.
And so the only thing that survived around it, a lot of the buildings around it were demolished, but there's an office block you can see behind them, which is still there. It's kind of all 60s office
so
block.
It is.
But yeah, it's just, and if you didn't know it was there, you wouldn't go looking for it because it's kind of hidden off the main road.
Did you do any of the running around and jumping?
There were too many dog walkers around. I was
too much
on my own.
Mess.
It would be different if I had someone else with me to take photos. But no, I just literally went. And I don't know what it is about going to sites associated with things, even though they're long gone. But there's that sense of sort of almost breathing the same air they breathe.
Mm.
And just trying to, it's sort of that sense of, if you've seen The Time Machine, you know, the idea that the decades change, but you're in the same locations, and in a sense you share the same moment. There's something about that.
Did you see the Paul McCartney, James Corden special where he went back to his own house?
I have to go.
It's brilliant. The scene where he goes back to his old house is very...
Oh, in Fortland Road.
Yeah, very bizarre seeing him there. And he's just banging away on the piano.
You know that city? I mean, I go back to Liverpool every so often, and it is a magical city in the way it's constructed. And there's a particular Hope Street.
Yes.
And you walk along it and you go past the Philharmonic and you get to the Liverpool Institute of Performing Arts. And it makes you think, if you know the film Yellow Submarine? When I went to Liverpool the first time, I'd only ever seen it through that weird animated view of Yellow Submarine. But it's kind of like that in real life.
Yeah, with a little yellow submarine chasing you behind.
Yeah, and the kind of, you know, all those old Georgian buildings. You know, it's this weird city built on different generations and the wealth that has gone, but the wealth that is there now, which is still cultural. It fascinates me. And it's a city that I dream about a lot because it definitely feels like it's a dream city.
It is. Oh, I love Liverpool so much.
If you need somebody to love, just look into my eyes. I'll be there to make you feel right. If you're feeling sorry and sad, I'd really sympathize. Don't you be sad, just call me tonight.
So, vinyl fans, we are now flipping over to side two and another crack start with Any Time At All with a bang, straight in.
Yeah, and in a sense I'd forgotten this song because it's sort of got a similar energy to Tell Me Why. But this was the thing, it was side two playing when I walked into R Price Records on St John's Road, and I just thought, all these songs that never even made it into the film, that a lot of people won't have heard, it's a whole album in itself.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I have strong feelings about this song. I think it's obviously a great song, but I don't know if you have any.
Again, it's one of those Lennon's lyrics, the desperation. It's
oh God, go on.
It's,
I obviously don't think enough about the lyrics.
Well, it's literally begging her any time at all, all you got to do is call and I'll be there. He's desperate, whatever she's done or whatever she's, or he's done more likely.
I mean, I shouldn't be overthinking. I sometimes wonder, were they just very good at just making up stories that they thought that's what pop songs are about? I don't get the feeling any of these were scenarios that applied to John Lennon's life.
I think that because he was married to Cynthia, by then it had got out and the fans were allowed to know that this man was actually married. It must have been weird writing the formulaic love songs. He probably didn't want to give too much away about Cynthia, but he was being forced almost to write a love song for the fans.
I think it's where he's writing it as if he weren't married, because that's what pop stars did. If you think back to the 50s, all those songs which are aimed very much at young teenage record buyers, which are all, you know, they make you feel that he's thinking of you.
Yeah.
That, you know.
No one else. How do they do that?
Have we talked enough about Ringo?
Well, there's not really much to say about Ringo because he doesn't sing anything on this album.
He does very good drumming, though.
His drumming is awesome.
Oh, I've got a Ringo story. Do you want to hear my Ringo story?
I want to hear your Ringo story,
again,
yes.
I didn't actually encounter him, but Ringo and Barbara Bach famously crashed their Mercedes into the Robin Hood roundabout on the A3, right like a couple of miles from where I used to live as a kid. And the day that accident happened, they closed the whole A3. And I remember being late for school. And it was really weird, because even on the day, I'm sure, my father said, oh, he's crashed his Mercedes. Everyone knew it was a Mercedes. And my father likes his cars, so I think he was quite interested in that. And if you ever see, there's a photograph of the crash, because the guy whose garage was called out to take the car off servicing, you know, obviously it was his moment of fame. And the car, you think about what 70s cars were like, it's really badly crushed. And they got very badly injured. They had suffered terrible spinal injuries. And of course, he was drunk. And that's when they both went into rehab. And they went through a massive detox. And that's the moment that changed his life, when they nearly died in that car crash.
And you were nearly late
for
school.
I was late for school. I was late for school. So that's my encounter.
That's a dramatic story.
But it is a dramatic story.
Yeah, well. But he's not, I mean, Ringo was so huge in the film. You know, he was one of the main parts in the film. But
I love
his not represented
scene.
On the album.
I actually found that quite distressing, because he was so unfairly treated. You know, when they chase him out the pub and it's not his fault.
Yeah.
And
they were quite typecast, though, weren't they?
I know. I did like his friendship with that kid, you know, the kind of mudlark that he meets, who's skipping school. I actually found, even as a kid watching that film, I used to find myself moved to tears. It was something incredibly tragic. And also, it's got that musical version of This Boy, which I think you can only get on...
On the American one.
Is there a version of it on Please Please Me?
Of the orchestral one?
No, just of the sung version.
No, it was a B-side.
It's on a compilation somewhere.
Yeah, it's on been a, quite a few
I really like that
compilations.
Song.
Why that wasn't a single? You know, that was a B-side.
And the instrumental version is quite lovely. It's quite mournful.
It is, yeah.
It's all around Kew Bridge and the kind of towpath there, very near Kew Gardens, where they filmed a lot of that. And it is beautiful and slightly haunting. And it's that thing, if you've ever gone walking on your own because you're feeling lonely, I think, you know... What I like about the movies isn't afraid to kind of have these slightly meandering, quiet moments where there's a real sense of melancholy about Ringo scenes, even if it's then ultimately played for comedy. I think it's that,
Poor old Ringo.
I think he was a great actor. You see The Magic Christian?
Yes. Thanks, Dad.
I've still never seen Caveman.
Oh, I've seen clips of it. Yeah.
Oh, also, have you ever seen That'll Be the Day with David Essex?
Yeah.
My God, that's a dark film. You think, well, that was 73. You think how close that is to the bone? Because it wasn't until I saw it, I realised how much it clearly is a sort of John Lennon character.
Yeah, absolutely.
And also, the thing about That'll Be the Day, wasn't it? It sort of hinted at his own background, because he'd worked in Butlins and things. Mm. So that sense of working in a sort of fairground or a sort of, you know...
Was it That'll Be the Day or Stardust that Keith Moon was in?
Keith Moon, I think, was in Stardust. So that's the one where he's full-on rock star and he starts taking drugs in a big way, and you have the whole breakdown in the kind of mansion in Spain. But I just thought it was quite interesting that these were films that were playing out in real time what was only just happening, you know, witnessing these rock stars kind of go nuts. Michael Apted made that one.
Yes,
the second one. I can't remember who directed the first one.
Neither can I.
We can look it up on the internet, but let's not.
Yeah, don't worry.
Let people shout at the podcast instead.
Yeah. But Keith Moon, when he was filming Stardust, he got very upset. He got very low because, while they were filming the live scenes, they were all David Essex fans, and he got crushed that none of them really knew who he was. And he got stoned off his head and terrorised, you know, sort of ripping up wallpaper and just went absolutely crazy.
It was a really scary time, I think, the mid-70s.
There was a lot of dodgy drugs going around at the time.
There was,
I think,
all kinds of horrible things going on. I'm still, it's slightly off piece, but, you know, I wrote a piece about the Bay City Rugglers, and when you find out what was going on, but, you know, their manager was a child abuser.
Really?
Yes. Tam Peyton was known as the Jimmy Savile of Scotland. He's died, which is why it's what to say all this. And he's rumoured to have been running. You know, he had all these network of flats in Edinburgh, and he used to keep, you know, underage runaway boys there. Oh. And so the NHS was investigating all these cases of these really damaged young men, and they all had a history of abuse, and they all had this connection, which is basically Tam Peyton kind of ran a paedophile ring, and he raped two members of the. Of the Bay City Rollers. I mean, Les McKeown has on record as saying that. And there was another one who was with them for a while, he said the same. And he used to drug them. They used to have these parties where drugs were handed out. And, you know, it's horrible. And it's never been properly investigated. There's been a good book about it. It's a good biography by Simon Spanton, I think it is.
Wow, what a story. Blimey.
No, right, I'm going to a bit of I'll Cry Instead.
Your loving man can do, 'cause of that I'll cry instead.
So this is Country John, Sad John, Evocative John,
Angry
Lonely
John,
John. Angry John.
John. It's a good line, isn't it? I've got a chip on my shoulder that's bigger than my feet.
Yeah. Which sort of took him through his whole career, wasn't it, that line?
Yeah, no, the lyrics are amazing to all these John songs.
Yeah.
But a lot of them are quite disturbing when you stop and think about them. But we don't stop and think about them.
No, no. I think because this is very sort of Carl Perkins-y era, and a lot of country songs tend to be, you know, my baby's left me and this kind of thing. I wonder if they thought, we've done a country song, so it's got to be sad lyrics.
It's also interesting, if you imagine Ringo singing this, you know, when you think about that song on Help he sings, and they're going to put me in the movies.
Oh, Act Naturally.
Act Naturally, which immediately is much more recognisable, yeah, than the Hank Williams song. John's delivery is just so different. Who's playing that twangy guitar?
That's George, yeah.
Presumably.
Yeah. It definitely wasn't Ringo.
Has it got, what is it? What's the causing the twang? Has it got some kind of echo thing going on it?
I think he's using the Rickenbacker. George loved Carl Perkins. I think he's just trying to emulate that.
Again, it's just a great song. It's like, I see it like a wagon rolling down the road. It's got a momentum to it. It's got an energy to it. And it's just perfectly formed.
Yeah, reminds me very much of I'm a Loser from the next album.
Okay.
Similar sound. If you play the two together, you can almost mash them up.
You can't dance to this, can you? Because it's one of the things I found, could you really dance to it?
You could bounce to it more than dance, I think.
Yeah, but she definitely couldn't dance to it.
No.
Unless you were, I think Americans would know how to dance to this.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, there's a certain kind of country style dancing you'd have to do, but you can't dance to it.
No. I might try in a moment, see how we go. I think you could do, what's it call it, with
the
hoedowns, maybe.
You could swing your partners to it.
You could.
Yeah, but it's not quite right. You know, it doesn't sound enough like a country song.
No.
That's, again, what makes it musically interesting is it sort of sounds, it's a new hybrid. It's like a Frankenstein, in a positive way. You know, you recognise it comes from country, but they've turned it into something else. But it's not quite a 60s pop song.
Yeah. But it's like you were saying the train analogy earlier. It's like the train's just arrived in the deep south and briefly taken a detour.
They've changed mode of transport, and they're now on a wagon.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sorry, it's not a really kind of glamorous sort of metaphor, is it? But I am struck by this album is an album for people who love public transport.
Yeah.
It's just, yeah, you've kind of got a rhythm and emotion carrying you along, and you've got on board a kind of perfect, you're on a particular form of transport, and it carries you along, and then it delivers you at the end, and you get off at your station, and then you get onto something else.
Lovely.
Sorry, that's
no,
such
I
a
love this.
Boring,
it's
comparison. Not very.
It's awesome.
Artistic.
You say you will love me if I have to go. You'll be thinking of me somehow. I will know someday when I'm lonely, wishing you weren't so far away. Then I will remember things we said today.
So, Things We Said Today, John Ellis?
Yeah, it's my favourite one.
Ah.
I think.
I thought I wrote that term down about the
name. Yeah, find it. If you can.
Oh, Picardy Third.
Oh, very nice. Right, you must say that. So this is another song which does that minor to major thing, doesn't it?
Picardy Third.
Oh, so that's what it's called. God, it's beautiful.
Without looking it up.
It's beautiful. This is my favourite sound on the whole album. It's that echoing sound of those kind of... The guitar feels like it's being played like a harp to me, at speed.
Yeah. We were talking recently about the White Album. Originally, it was going to be a Doll's House. We were saying how a lot of the songs are like going into a different room in a Doll's House. But this room in particular is lush and beautiful.
And, I mean, I haven't thought to analyse the lyrics, but even just from the title, it's quite sophisticated, isn't it? Mm. It's sort of like some kind of play for today, you know, a sort of a married couple who are reflecting on their life. I mean, it sort of feels quite mature for, what? How old were they? 20? Was he 24, Paul McCartney?
I think he was 23, wasn't he, in 64? Lyrically and musically, just from the previous year when they were doing She Loves You and how far
this
and quickly
the song,
they moved on.
When I heard this in that record shop, that I just thought, this is the side two to an album. This is side two to an album, and it never got any kind of major play. I mean, did they release singles off any of side two? They didn't, did they?
No, this was a B-side, but they used to perform it live, and George would come in and sing the main melody, and Paul would sing his own harmony on top. And that was one of the... They used to have these moments, the screaming moments, which they'd often play up to. So George would dramatically move in when it was his turn to join in for the harmonies. And they knew what they were doing.
It's just... it's lovely. You just want to let it crash over you like waves of the ocean. It's just that beautiful.
And it is that bittersweet because it's all in the minor and then, as you say, that powerful middle eight just crashes through.
Are there obvious songs that were influenced by these kinds of numbers? I'm just thinking, you know, because this side too of A Hard Day's Night, I'm just thinking all those musicians who must have listened to it and thought, like we are, this is, because it is better than the side one, I would argue, musically.
Yeah.
And I just wonder, you know, are there recognisable tracks?
I would say that it's so broad.
Out of this.
I don't know about individual songs, but I'd say the broadest influence would have been the fact that they'd written all of the songs, so then bands started writing their own songs, you know, the Stones and the Kinks.
I always think of the Yardbirds being very influenced by them. And I know they're sort of contemporary, but you know, songs like Heart Full of Soul and, I mean, For Your Love is probably my favourite song of the 60s. They have, and again, I suppose they've got a great guitar player.
Yeah, they didn't do bad, did they, really?
There's a few things in common between George Harrison and Clapton.
One in particular.
But it's the kind of, I keep seeing it as a visual image, but it's a sense of this rippling curtain of guitar chords that characterise the songs.
Lovely.
I'm doing my little hand movements.
It's lovely. Oh, if you could see this, folks, it's just a thing
I'm
of beauty.
I'm waving my hand vertically.
Yeah. Right. Starting with the whoa, whoa, wah, we can move on to When I Get Home.
It's got the start of a song that feels like it's going to end in a call to the police and then a call out to a domestic, doesn't it? Do we ever find out what he's going to say when he gets home?
I don't know. I think he kind of implies, I always think of it, he's on tour and it's what he's going to tell Cynthia when he gets home. But
what is he going to tell her?
I don't know.
I've got a whole lot of things to tell her.
He mentions that he's possibly the most unromantic line ever. I'm going to love her till the cows come home. So, I don't know if that's...
I guess if you're a farmer, that might be quite a romantic line.
Yeah, only till this evening. And
there's not much emotional progression in this song, I think it's fair to say. And I remember when I read, you know that... Again, I think it's a Mark Lewisohn book. No, it's Roy Carr book. The Beatles...
Illustrated Records.
The Illustrated Records.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I remember reading that very young, because, again, my brother got that book when it came out. I think it was 78. So I read that cover to cover. And... You know, he kept going on about John Lennon's weird problems with women and his obsessions. And I didn't understand at the time, because all I ever listened for at that age was the joy of the music. And you sing along to the lyrics without ever really listening to them. But now I'm an older woman. You know, it is a bit troubling, isn't it?
Yeah. There's a few lines, actually. I find the line, I bet I'll love her more till I walk out that door again. I find that unconvincing. So he's back from tour and he's saying, I love you, but only until I walk out that door.
See,
I don't understand that.
To continue with my public transport metaphor, essentially he's stuck on the treadmill or the escalator or whatever of touring, going back home and going, and it's quite an unsatisfactory life if you're a married man. So I guess one could try and read generously into it and say he's reflecting on the fact he's trapped in a Kafka-esque hell of eternal touring, coming home, trying to keep your wife happy, but actually you're never quite at home anywhere. But it's not really a song about very much that's interesting, is it?
No.
So having said I love side two, I'm not sure I like the song that much.
It's the wahs that get me every time. I can't handle the wah. I don't know why.
Rami, how does the wah bit go?
Whoa, wah! That bit.
Yeah, it's a bit weird. I think it's a bit primal scream therapy.
It could be, couldn't it?
Pre-primal
Arthur Janoff had a brief
inspiration. Maybe it's some kind of early metaphor for the commuter husband trying to break free of the restrictions of conventionality. And was he living in Weybridge by this time?
No, not by 64. I think, weren't they?
It's a bit later.
Yeah.
By 66, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, they
yeah.
all end up, they you know, living in the most boring commuter belt part of Surrey. Because they're
Paul.
Accountant. Yeah, but Paul's a smart one.
Yeah, he knew what he was doing, didn't he?
Yeah.
I got something to say that might cause you pain.
Here
we go
again.
Catch you talking to that boy again. I'm gonna let you down and leave you flat. Because I told you before, oh, you can't do that.
Right, we've just been listening to You Can't Do That. We've been talking about John's lyrics in some of these songs, and it's quite an opener, isn't it, really?
You know, the Home Office does commercials now about how to identify emotional controlling abuse.
Oh, right.
Yeah, and it's, you know, young girls now, they say, you know, if your boyfriend's taking your mobile phone off you and policing your behaviour, these are all signs, and they tend to lead to more violent abuse in the end. And I just feel like this is the <Steve's> equivalent. This is the gateway.
That album could have...
Oh, man. Now you've maybe listened to the lyrics.
No,
you've kind of...
Like,
I thought I loved side two of this, but I don't feel quite so comfortable about it. You can't do that. Although he doesn't actually say he's going to hit her. He's just going to... Well, mind you, if you say
Let
leave you flat, that could be a sort of...
Leave you flat and deflated,
well,
maybe.
As opposed to knocked out on your back because I punched you.
I hope so. Yeah, that's what it means.
Yeah, it does.
It's
it means
a great
I'm going to walk away.
Yeah, just walk out that door.
It's really weird. Did people like songs like that? Or do you think they just didn't listen to the lyrics then?
I'm sure there are other songs like this. And I think, again, it's they didn't really care about the lyrics as much as the actual overall song. And I think they just got stuck in a rut.
But you think just, you know, they all listened to what the other was doing musically and then they thought, that makes a nice song, and no one really analysed it. I like the, what's the
clanking? Oh, the cowbell. Well, cowbell.
Is it? I like that.
Yeah.
Well, it sort of actually anticipates, one, it's got almost a pre sort of British, you know when white pop stars did slightly reggae things?
Oh,
it's
yeah.
Sort of anticipating that a bit.
Yeah.
But also, I just think, you know, the kind of whole 80s, Club Tropicana kind of tropical pop.
Yeah.
It's got that sense, ding, ding, ding.
Yeah, yeah.
Can I just get back up? There's a bit he said. What did you just say before?
The first before that's, well, it's the second time I've caught you talking to him. Do I have to tell you one more time? I think it's a sin. I think I'll let you down and leave you flat. I told you before, can't do that.
I think what we've learned, what I've learned, or been reminded of, going through this experience with you, Chris, is that one really shouldn't stop and think too much about the lyrics in the songs.
Basically, I'm going to stop doing these podcasts. It's just ruining it for you. I'm so sorry.
It's just weird because, you know, it's just... I'm not someone who's PC, but you think, why are these lyrics all about the same thing? They're all about obsessive jealousy. And it was noticed at the time, as I say, people like Will Cole was writing about this. And, I think it's as you get older and you study the lyrics and you just think... Weird, slightly obsessive, slightly controlling.
He did disown a lot of his songs later on, didn't he? But he when he got together with Yoko, I think there was the Jan Wenner interview for
Rolling Stone.
Rolling Stone.
Yeah.
And he went through a lot of Beatles tracks and he disowned most of them. I think the idea being dismissing all of these kind of songs, but he was just dismissing
And Your Bird Can Sing, brilliant songs. So his history now reveals all these great songs that he's dissing. I think his plan was to remove all of these from his past.
It's really interesting how people reassess the different ages of John. So I remember talking to a female friend some years ago who was raving about how, you know, once he and Yoko got together, you know, he suddenly became this amazing born again kind of pure vegetarian, you know, and it's when he gets really healthy and he kind of becomes a feminist. And I can kind of see that argument, and everyone's entitled, aren't they, to say I've changed my attitudes and you know, and I think I've become a better man. So I can understand why he might feel embarrassed or felt embarrassed about these things, and it doesn't change the fact that, you know, at the time, I think most people were just listening to him with the joy of listening to them. I mean, I was listening to well, if you think about, sorry, I don't know why this is on my mind, other than I was interviewing the head of BBC editorial policy about Cliff Richard today. But the lyric, okay, the living doll, I'm going to shut her up in a box. Yeah. No big hunk can take her away. No one, I think, would accuse Cliff Richard of, you know, having planned to do that. These are just how you wrote pop songs in the 60s. They were... They were just the convention.
Yeah. And I'm sticking with that.
So I'm giving the Cliff Richard defence to John Lennon here.
Absolutely. Yes. He needs it. But also, sidetracking slightly, check out the Nilsson version. Absolutely brilliant.
What of You Can't Do That?
Yeah. Absolutely brilliant.
What's it like?
He kind of multi-tracks himself. The backing vocals are all different backing vocals from different Beatles songs that he kind of
flutters around. Amazing.
It's brilliant. Listen to it as soon as you can. Absolutely wonderful song.
Because there aren't that many Beatles songs that are bettered by being covered.
No. Nilsson's,
they usually destroy.
Nilsson's the way to go. He's
is,
done
that
it.
The only, is that the only Beatles song that's been a better cover than it was in the original?
I don't know if the Nilsson version's better, but it's
sufficiently
on a par.
Different to have its own artistic merit.
Yeah. Okay. But have a listen, you'll love it.
One, two.
You know, Paul forgot to say
13.
And George,
God, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, God, I'm sorry. I was just watching George and I thought, it must be all right.
One, two.
You know.
14.
One, two.
Oh, hold on, hold on, hold on.
15.
Falling over there. It's every time you jump like that, you make a bit of wind on it.
You know, if you break my heart, I'll go, but I'll be back again.
I'll be back. The final track on this amazing album. What are your thoughts on this?
I can't get over how beautiful those key changes are in it. And there was that weird line, you could find better things to do than to break my heart again. God, that's quite clever. And I think, you know, I hadn't really thought about this as a John song. I sometimes didn't listen enough to who was singing. And so I thought about this as more of a Paul song, and it feels much more like And I Love Her. Partly that's the musical construction of it. But also I think the sort of, the jealousy element is quite ameliorated. It's quite softened, and it feels like quite a... apologetic song.
Yeah. Essentially, the lyrics aside, it's Beatlemania, the whole album, isn't it? And you've got this fast, thrusting, energetic pop band in their prime, full of excitement and enthusiasm. And this takes it to another level. You know, most bands would have ended with another sort of twist and shout.
Mm.
And the fact they did this as the final track on the album is, you know, they were thinking, and this points the way forward to the next album.
So there's two things I noticed about this musically. And one is, there's this kind of tumbling of like water, of the way the chords fall on top of each other. But also, I was thinking almost something Philip Glass minimal about the way that the chords change from major to minor and back again. And that sense of, I mean, the thing about minimalism in music is not that it's repetitive, but it's like there's a spiral. So it's always slightly different, but it's sort of moving onwards. And I think... Sorry, this makes me sound like I know a lot about music, but I have spent some time talking about Philip Glass, and I do think it's got that sense of it's tumbling forwards like a kind of constant spiral, always musically going on further. And, of course, it fades out, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it changes from, again, the major to the minor. That's how it ends, just rocking from side to side.
And there's a sliding doors element to it.
Yes.
I think... I will probably be the only person in your podcast who's managed to turn a Beatles album into a metaphor for public transport.
Absolutely.
It's very unromantic, but somehow it works.
It's perfect.
But yeah, and as you say, what a place to end that album, where it just takes you off into a sort of dreamlike fading away.
Yeah.
So you said this is a jumping off point for the next album. What's the next album again?
That's Beatles for Sale, which is more of a country.
Well, which is considered a bit folky. Of a sort of tired album, isn't it? It's like it's a.
I think
it's got some amazing songs in it, but yeah. It's not. When you think Rubber Soul is to come, it's considered an album that was rushed out.
Well, it was, but I think most people say that because of the cover, because they look absolutely knackered on the cover, and they are, you know. But the songs themselves are. They're doing stuff that they did at the Star Club and the Cavern. Probably they've run out of songs, but as a whole, it really works, and they're exploring country. It's a kind of their country album, and I love
that. Is that
album.
The one with that song about time after time? You refuse to even listen.
Oh, you won't see me. No, that's Rubber Soul.
That's Rubber Soul.
Yeah,
there is a song on this. Is it? I don't want to spoil the party.
Yes. Yeah. Don't read the lyrics.
No, I won't read it. God, anything which involves John Lennon and parties is probably not worth reading the lyrics about.
So, Samira, thank you so much. How would you sum up this album? Let's maybe not move away from the lyrics.
Yeah, right, no, I feel we've given John a hard time. And I don't. I'm not one of those people who obsesses about looking at the past through the prism of kind of current political correctness at all. So it's partly done with humour.
Yeah,
just
of course.
In case anyone
we love John.
Me and we do love John. For me, this album captures the magic of the Beatles. And you see, I was born in 68, and I'm very conscious of having been alive in that decade, but missed it. And from my earliest years, you know, from the age of two or three, I can remember the first time I saw the Beatles on some archive footage on the news. I'd have been about two or three. And you know how people talk about how black and white went into colour with the 60s?
Yeah.
The thing about being a kid in the early 70s was you were sort of seeing that backwards, the sense that you'd missed this amazing colourful decade. It was over, but it had happened. And so it almost felt like a fairy tale. The 60s felt like this fairy tale to me. And the Beatles, in their Hard Day's Night period, it was the kind of magical heart of it. I mean, I would argue that probably when I was a child, I probably had slightly more passion for Help because it was colour and because there was a childlike playfulness about it. But those two films just is a sense of this magical time that I never quite missed, but I knew had happened. And I used to talk to witnesses. And over the years, I've met so many people, you know, who talk about that time. And I remember talking to Barry Miles. I did this whole, I did a whole program for Radio 4 Extra where we did a whole day
brilliant
of
program.
Things, thank you, about all the figures on the Sgt. Pepper album. And I spent time with them talking about the making of the album and just what it was like being in London in the 60s. And again, because I lived in Marylebone, that same district, but I was living there literally 30 years later. And he talked about, you know, all those concerts you could go to, all the new music that was happening, all the avant-garde stuff that Paul in particular was into. And the fact that the 60s was this amazing explosive decade in which it wasn't just that the Beatles chose to investigate it, to their credit they did, but it was genuinely, that was the moment when it broke through in London. And, you know, I remember going home and talking to my mum about the 60s and the Beatles, because there she was with her beehive hairdo, you know, working for the BBC. And she did say it was exciting. You know, I mean, it was a weird decade. You still had those no coloureds, no Irish, no dogs signs, you know, in rentals until the Race Relations Act. That was 66, wasn't it? So you forget, you know, these two different sides of the 60s coexist. But on the whole, it was this exciting, liberating time. And the Beatles epitomised everything that was positive about it. And so for this album, for me, just captures the magic. It's like a fairy tale for me.
Samira, thank you so much. That's been absolutely fascinating. To keep up to date with future podcasts, go to iamtheeggpod.com. And if you want to follow Samira on Twitter, it's Samira Ahmed UK. Samira, thank you so much. It's been fantastic.
My pleasure. Thank you. I'm going to give you a confession. Chris, which okay. I feel I shouldn't. And decide whether it should go on. But I feel, as we're talking about the Beatles, there was an album I would never volunteer to do this for, which is Abbey Road. And it's partly because I don't like all of it that much, but also I went and bought it on cassette tape from Tower Records at Piccadilly Circus. It was a period when I was completing the gaps in my collection, and I had spent £400 on a cassette player when I bought my first big hi-fi with my big paycheck when I joined Newsnight as a reporter.
Brilliant.
And so I bought it on cassette to play in great quality. And I didn't really know the album. So which is the track? Is it the very, very end track, which ends with this really long chord or something?
It's
not A Day in the Life or anything. I know it's from Abbey Road. What's that song?
Is it I Want You? She's So Heavy with that. Down, down, yeah. down,
and
down,
does it end
down,
suddenly?
Down. Yeah. Down, 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 down.
Yeah. Okay, so my confession is I bought this album and I played it, and when that happened I just thought, there's something wrong with this tape. There's definitely something. The album's finished early, and obviously there's something wrong with the tape, and I took it back to Tower Records.
Oh, yes.
And I said, there's something wrong with this tape, could I have a refund please? And I think if I had asked for a replacement,
yeah,
and then taken the replacement home and heard it was the same, I might have worked out that it's supposed to end that way.
Yeah.
But maybe I've decided I didn't really want the album. And I just remember the clerk at the desk looking at me when I said, I don't think it ended properly. There's something wrong. And I thought the idea that a sort of a woman in her early 20s in the 1990s could not recognise the experimental ending of a Beatles track was really rather
Absolutely.
Sweet and sad at the same
time. You paid a lot of money for it, to be fair.
And it just didn't sound right. It didn't end properly.